First of all, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate that. So why don't we start with people who are unfamiliar with what ITN does in the community. Can you explain what ITN is all about?
We're advocates for access to trails of all kinds, be they water trails, motorized trails, non-motorized trails, and safety.
Okay, and so I've seen what is probably marks of you guys making new trails at Abercrombie and other locations. Like every time you see something that is kind of like shaped up, I'm like, that could be ITN. Is that something you guys do often, the repair of trails?
Yeah, maintenance and repair of trails, volunteer trail development and improvement. There's the Channel Trail on Near Island, which has been moving fairly slowly, but we were involved in a lot of bigger trail projects, like the trail hardening projects out at Anton Larson that spanned the last few years, and then the trail hardening project on Spruce Island, which was a big project. And I think there was going to be a little bit of follow-up to that this year, but I haven't honestly been back long enough to know how much of that happened or not. I'm sorry to say I've been gone for about 3 months. So.
Okay. And I'm going to ask you in a second about some of the other projects you have worked on in the past, just to kind of give people an idea of what in their daily life is affected by the nonprofit that you represent. But first of all, just to give people an overview of why you've been absent, like what basically was going on there.
In the fall of 2014, we applied to the NOAA Community Marine Debris Grant Program on a national competitive grant to do a project to do a large-scale, point-to-point marine debris cleanup and removal on of Shuyak Island State Park in the eastern Kodiak Archipelago.
Okay. And so you've been away doing that for a while.
I left Kodiak on the 6th of June, and I think my first return date was sometime in mid-September. I was there. There was a marine debris removal ongoing that I was there to help load the marine debris, but I had to stay there to clean up the gear and the facilities that the state park allowed us to use. And I eventually got enough of the gear packed and whatnot that I was able to come back, and I've been back now for, I think, 6 nights.
Okay. And so in the past, has ITN done any other projects related to, like, beach cleanup and land cleanup regarding, like, marine debris?
Yeah. Our executive director, Andy Schroeder, started doing marine debris cleanup projects here on Kodiak in, I think, 2005 or 2006. And I think in 2007, he got a small grant to do a cleanup not far off the road system here, I think Pillar Creek. But he quickly obtained funding from what was then the Marine Conservation Alliance Foundation to do cleanup projects on small cleanup projects with volunteers on Shuyak, on Tagetik Island, south of Kodiak, in the Trinity Islands. I think they did some work at Halibut Bay on the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge. And I believe there's been some cleanup on Sitkanak, and I may not have all of the locations yet. But yes, Andy's been active in marine debris cleanup for quite a long time. And how I got to Kodiak to become an employee of Island Trails was that Andy saw the potential for writing a community marine debris removal grant to do a cleanup of one of Alaska's most wonderful state critical habitat areas, Tagetik Island, which is at one time the largest concentration of harbor seals in Alaska, and some people say possibly, you know, in a much larger area, potentially the world. And that project was funded, but the person that Andy'd hired to take on that project declined the position sometime after, you know, she'd accepted. And so the project languished, and he needed someone to do it. And I had been over here working for Island Trails, doing some contract work, doing kayak training for some of their volunteers. And while I was here, he said, hey, you know, there's this position, something you might ought to consider. I think you'd be good. And I was pretty wrapped up in running my kayak business in Homer and kind of hard to think about. But about a month later, I realized that my kayak business had sort of hit the wall as the economy accordioned in 2008. Didn't catch up to me until 2011 or 12, but I really did need a job. And I really enjoyed Andy and all the things that he'd been doing. So I applied and, you know, I was hired. And I came over in September of 2012 to take on part of the then Safe Routes to School study, as well as the marine debris project on Tagetik. And so that's how I got here.
Yeah. And you said you're a kayaker, clearly. So where do you come from?
Well, I was born in Illinois, but grew up in Puerto Rico. And I went to college in Oregon and stayed there working for 7 or 8 years after college. And then I came to Alaska to go to graduate school and live here. And that was in 1981. And I've really never left.
Well, Kodiak seems like an amazing place to kayak, especially during the summer. So, like, where did you pick up the kayaking skill?
I got pretty interested in canoeing when I lived in the interior. And I got interested enough that I became relatively proficient and became an instructor and worked for what was then the only serious canoe instruction company in Alaska, Canoe Alaska, run by Ron and Lou Davis from Fairbanks. And I worked for them for a couple seasons. And at some point, I realized that I wanted to work in paddling, that I'd been running the Alaska Bird Observatory in Fairbanks for 7 years and had been successful, but an incredible burnout. And I resigned and took a year to sort of, you know, assess my options. And I decided to start a kayak touring company or a sea kayak company in Homer because there wasn't a company quite like what I wanted to run anywhere in Alaska. And Homer seemed like a good place to do it. And so I moved to Homer in 1999, 98 or something, and started the Alaska Kayak School there then. And mostly what we did was training, certifying guides, training people to be independent paddlers, instructor training. We also did a fair bit of expedition support, and we did have a rental program, and sales became a natural outgrowth of that. So we were doing just a little bit of everything, and it was, you know, relatively successful for 13 or 14 years until, you know, we just couldn't raise our prices to keep up with rising expenses and some other things. And then we just decided to not close the doors because we're still running it now kind of as a side, you know, just a part-time business. But it was no longer a full-time concern. And then I moved to Kodiak in 2012, September. And I've been working for Island Trails ever since.
Hmm. What surprised me about Island Trails Network eventually, when I found this out, is that kayaking is actually a pretty big part of some of the expeditions you guys do. So for this recent project, can you talk a little bit about how kayaking played into that?
Yeah. You know, I've been a pretty devoted paddler for about 20 years, and it was the main way in which I recreated in the outdoors. I have some other health issues, and I can't walk very well and are not as well as I used to. And so hiking is not something I'm comfortable doing very much. It's actually really uncomfortable. And backpacking kind of left my activities, you know, some time ago because of that. And as I was winding up the Tagetik Marine Debris Project, which was a wonderful project with lots of wonderful support from the state of Alaska and, you know, many volunteers from Kodiak and other places, I realized that we really needed to springboard into another marine debris project, and that because we had been successful, we probably had a chance to get funding to do a different project. And a big part of these projects, when you make a grant proposal in the Community Marine Debris Program to NOAA, is that you have to provide a match in in-kind services of some kind on at least a one-to-one basis. So if you're going to ask for $120,000, you need to provide at least $120,000 in labor or logistics or, you know, some other equipment or some other aspect, and then you can apply and get cash so that you can rent buy the plane time and rent the landing craft to remove the debris and buy all the supplies that you need. And so we needed to find a project, and we tried lots of different projects. Like we proposed, we investigated the reality of doing a marine debris cleanup on Marmot Island, thinking that the sea lion population as potentially being harmed by marine debris, that it would be a no-brainer. And because it's an endangered species, we were essentially stonewalled, and that really wasn't feasible. There was no access to those beaches by anyone at this time. And so the researchers did not want any additional disturbance there, which totally understandable. We looked into doing a project on the refuge, which has so much coastline and undoubtedly has so many thousands of pounds of marine debris that have accumulated on it. But because the refuge, Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge, is managed by a federal agency, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we can't use any of the in-kind services from a federal agency as a match towards a federal grant. So it's not the ideal marriage of ITN's efforts and an agency in order to apply for this particular grant program, the Community Marine Debris Grant Program in NOAA. So we had to find something else. And I had, as my career in Homer had started, you know, winding down, I had offered and completed 3 guided trips in Shuyak State Park, or the near waters. We would come on Delta 44 or 43 from Homer with the kayaks all tied onto the rails with all the clients, and then we would get dropped off in Carey Inlet, and depending on the weather then, we'd go counterclockwise or counter, and we would circumnavigate Shuyak with a group. And so I became familiar with Shuyak, and I came to really appreciate its beauty, natural values, wildlife values. It's just a wonderful place to hang out. It's a wonderful place to paddle. It's a wonderful place to hike, fish. The wildlife is, you know, stunning. The scenery is stunning. Everything about it. But as I learned more about marine debris in the Kodiak Archipelago, the Gulf of Alaska, and Alaska in general, it turned out that Shuyak is one of the areas most heavily impacted by marine debris pollution in the state, aside from a couple other places like Hinchinbrook Island, Gore Point on the Kenai Peninsula, Montague Island, and one of the other recent places where Andy Schroeder and the Gulf of Alaska Keeper have been doing work, Kayak Island. Those places are absolutely off the chart. I mean, more than, it's just not imaginable the amount of debris there. But the aerial surveys that were used to evaluate the relative abundance of marine debris in the state, which were done by flying from Ketchikan essentially to Cold Bay and going along the shoreline at 500 feet and looking for marine debris and photographing the beaches. Well, Shuyak is rated pretty high. There's a lot of debris there. We Island Trails and many other parties, NGOs and government agencies in Alaska, went through a prioritization process to identify the areas in Alaska where there was going to be likely most Japanese tsunami debris based on historic patterns of accumulation, but also based on some aerial surveys that were done immediately after the Japanese tsunami in March of 2011. And so Shuyak was pretty high on all that because of its natural values, because of its recreational values, because of its cultural values, because there's a tremendous number of cultural sites, native cultural sites on Shuyak, historic native cultural sites, and because of its wildlife values. And so there's a large priority placed on areas that have high value across the board, which Shuyak did. Oh, and fisheries values as well. In addition to which, there's a high value placed on land management units that have management plans that are in place that state that these areas are going to be managed for their natural values. So those things all played in our favor. The fact that it was state land, because it's a state park, so anything that the state parks did could be considered a match towards our grant. And the fact that it had all these high values and a high priority for a cleanup made it easier for us to consider that that was the right place to do a cleanup. And then it occurred to me that even though I'd grown up on boats, and even though I had driven motorboats almost my entire young adult life, that I really didn't enjoy motorboats very much, and that I didn't like using, you know, gas and oil all the time and burning gas and worrying about whether or not the spark plugs were going to work, or there's oil in the oil in the fuel. Or I think that's all great, and I know that's what everyone in Kodiak, you know, thrives on, but I did it as a young adult and as a child, and, you know, I got just burned out on it, and I had no interest in that. So I didn't want the cleanup to be boat-based. And it occurred to me that because I'd been on Shuyak and I knew it was feasible to circumnavigate the island, and my simplistic view was that we could, the cleanup crews could travel in kayaks to the beaches, that we could collect the debris, put the debris in Alpar bags, the yellow and green plastic bags that everyone uses, and stockpile them in super sacks. And then at the end of the season, we would come back with a motorboat and remove the stuff and bring it to Kodiak. Now, the project has many more aspects to it, but at its core, that seemed like a viable plan. And we double-checked with some of our representatives at NOAA in advance of the grant announcement being given, and they seemed to think that it would be an interesting project and viable, and that we should probably pursue a project like that, which we did. And ironically, we applied, I think, in November of 2014. We pushed the button on send on the grant, which is you'd apply electronically. It takes, you know, 4 to 6 weeks to get one of these packets together, especially if you haven't done them before, and I never had. And ironically, July 15th, the day that the barge of 2015, the day the barge was coming to remove all of the debris that we'd accumulated in the ITN yard, something like 800 super sacks or something, some ridiculous number of super sacks. That morning, as I was trying to get up and get ready to go get all of that debris out of our yard in one moment, I got the acceptance email from NOAA that we had been funded for the Shuyak project. So this summer's effort was, we had originally decided to do it in 2 summers, but the logistics of getting all the stuff to Shuyak and getting it all back was a lot. And it seemed to be more efficient to do one long season and then spend the next year doing the other parts of the project, which are to sort the debris with members of the community, to evaluate the quality of the debris and the types of debris, to try and come to some understanding about the dominant kinds of debris that are on Shuyak, and to try and come to some realization and make recommendations for how we might minimize the debris that is on Shuyak as it might reflect what's in the Kodiak Archipelago. And that's something yet to come in this particular project. So all we've done this summer is go to Shuyak, start the cleanup from one point, and move almost in an interrupted belt all around the shorelines of all the bays and the coves and all of the shorelines that we, at the start of the project, assumed were going to be where the debris was going to accumulate and, you know, sort of get as far as we could within the one season, and then stockpile all the debris, go back with a larger vessel and load it onto the vessel by using a skiff and a crane, and then bring it back to here, unload it, and take it to our marine debris yard, which, fast forward a bit, you know, has all happened, and we have 75% of the debris removed. We're doing the last removal trip starting this Wednesday at 5, and we are looking for a couple people to help us. They need to be adults. They should be strong and fit and not be nursing any injuries, no bad ankles or shoulders or anything, because it's pretty demanding work. But we've got 3/4 of the collection and removal done. Our original plan was perhaps a bit naive, but I'm not sure naive is the right word, because it makes us sound silly. was that we, based on past experience, I've been able to circumnavigate Shuyak in 4 days. And I thought, well, if I can circumnavigate Shuyak in 4 days, we can just poodle along, sea kayak camping, stopping at beaches, picking up stuff, stockpiling it. We could pick it up later. Well, it became pretty obvious not long after I had arrived there in June of this year that that was a silly notion, that that there was nowhere that you could walk or paddle on Shuyak where there wasn't some evidence of marine debris. The more time we spent there, the more we discovered that the intensity and the volume of marine debris was pervasive. And as an afterthought, we divided the shoreline into 2 nautical mile segments so that we could have a handle on, you know, just some units. So it wasn't just some, you know, generic. And so these units had have a geographic basis. And I could be fair to say that there was no segment that had no debris. Every segment had a lot of debris. And at this point, we've learned that the segments, well, we cleaned 45 miles. It was a 45-mile stretch of coastline.
Wow.
And we know that there's a few habitats in those 45 miles that we just couldn't sample. So we know there's some small areas in there that didn't get the kind of attention that the others did. But there was 3 main areas. There was the shorelines of the interior bays where there's virtually ever no significant wave impact. There are the shorelines of the channels and of the inlets that lead to the protected waters where trees will fall down off the bank in the protected waters and then they just dry in place and all the branches remain, the roots remain. And so on big tides, the tidal streams carry materials, especially nets and rope, into the interior bays, and then they simply wash up on one of the shorelines depending on, you know, wave action, tide height, and they get tangled in the roots and branches of the trees and get embedded in the soil. And I'm sure on some big tides, some of these line and nets got placed up on the bank, literally on the edge of the forest, but on the forest floor. And they also became embedded in the forest floor right at the edge of the shoreline. Well, we learned pretty quickly that there was nets and line and other debris in everywhere in the interior bays. And so that was a big reality check. We thought we were going to be cruising the outer coast, picking up a few bottles and a few jugs and a couple of buoys. But the nets and line that essentially had polluted the interior bays was punishing. It was substantial. So as we moved out towards areas where there's more wave impact, there's a zone where there's some wave impact and some effect of tidal streams carrying materials in. Out there, there was actually a little bit more volume of debris. And as we kept moving around our cleanup area, getting out to the outer coast beaches and some places where that are close to the outer coast, there was even a greater volume of debris. So now we have a map that we've been working on that shows that a lot of the interior bays were sporting between 1 and 4 super sacs per nautical mile. And there's an intermediate zone that's sporting between 5 and 9 super sacs per nautical mile. And then some of the areas on the outer coast, not all, are sporting something on the order of 10 to 16 super sacs or cubic yards. Each super sac is a cubic yard, and it's what we use to, you know, stockpile the debris for removal. And so what we were really surprised at is that there was such wide, well, one, that there was so much debris in the interior bays, and two, that there was so much distinct variation, or we think, now we have to do a little bit more analysis of this, but we think that the outer coast then is subject to debris that's delivered by tidal streams, it's delivered by wind, and it's delivered by wave action. But then that debris pretty quickly either gets thrown up pretty high and no longer goes back out into circulation. But the logs on the outer coast don't have any branches. They're just knocked smooth by the heavy action. So the nets that are out there, and there are some nets in line on the outer coast. They're not the dominant kind of debris on the outer coast. There's a lot of nets in line out there, but there's also tons of big plastic items like totes and jugs and bottles and stuff. And, you know, in between, there's sort of like a mixture of things. But we didn't expect there to be so much stuff in the interior bays. We didn't expect there'd be that much variability between, you know, two nautical mile segments in different zones that was... It just slowed us down. I mean, we thought we were going to get around the whole island, and that's 140 nautical miles. But we got 45, and 45 is a lot of shoreline, but it's not 140 miles. But there's no way we could have gone any more quickly. We were just wanted to do a point A to point B, so we couldn't really cheat, as it were.
How much of the debris is from tsunami, and how much is kind of like just washed up and like general marine debris?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. But because it's very difficult or impossible in many cases to pick up 10 items and say, oh, this came from, it's like there's no return address.
Yeah.
You know, it's like receiving mail without a return address. You know somebody put it in the post or in the postal system, but you don't really know where, there's no stamp, you know, have no idea where it came from. But what is really interesting, one of the things that we learned, and it's hard to say now exactly how much we learned about this, is that most of the debris that has writing on it, I shouldn't say most, a lot of the debris that has writing on it, and it has all the appearance of being a predominant amount of the debris, everything from plastic bottles to jugs, to 5-gallon jugs, to buckets, to fish crates, to it does have oriental writing on it. Now, we had a couple of our volunteers that came from Singapore. They're essentially from Chinese families, but they have a relative breadth to read some of the other languages. And so the dominant languages are, to some degree, English and some of the big items like jugs and buckets and things, but also Japanese, Chinese, Korean, but then a fair amount of especially male body products and alcohol bottles with Russian writing, some with Greek writing, some with Indian writing, like Indian from India, or Thai. We're not sure yet. We're going to try and analyze some of this. But there's literally materials with addresses and company names from almost all over the world.
So just, it's not all marine, it's not all from the tsunami, it's so much variety from around the world.
I don't know that it's from all around the world or if it's from, ships that are crossing the Pacific, that are throwing things overboard from many different countries. I'm just not sure. But I can't say with any certainty that the materials we found are predominantly tsunami debris or not tsunami debris. There's an awful lot of Japanese stuff, but I don't know.
Right. And so we have only a couple of minutes left. But if a person is interested in volunteering in this last part of the Shuyak project, how do they reach out to you?
They can call Island Trails at 888-301-0568. And I think there's a menu. You can reach Andy Schroeder or myself. You can send me a personal message on Facebook, just Tom Pogson. You can email me at tom@islandtrails.org.
All right. Well, we've been talking about Shuyak, the project at Shuyak, and it's coming to a close very soon. It sounds like it's been an exciting adventure and successful so far.
Yep.
ITN is looking for volunteers. So, definitely check out their website and check them out. So thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you.